hearts is always aligned with Pastor Elvin's heart, and we always have a very, very good relationship. And hearing the stories and all the things and the testimonies of the work that you have outside, beyond the four walls, we definitely understand why our heart is aligned and beat on the same page. Yeah. The last time that I spoke was on Mother's Day. And we always say that the mother or the parent can say anything. But what about the child, right now? So yesterday, I had a workshop with the parents last night. And the parents was divided up, and they were looking through the questions that I was prepared. Like, what's the definition of success? And things like that. But I took the children. I took one 12, two 10 years old, and one 8-year-old. And I had them. And so the questions that was posed to them was, how do they rate their parents? How do they define nagging, for example? And things like that. And I'm glad to tell you some of the results that... So how do they rate their parent? And one child say, almost there. Almost there, right? And then another child says, can do better. Another child says, if only they would trust us better. Wow. Now, remember, 1-12, 2-10, 1-8. How do they define nagging? One of the child says, again and again and again. One child said that... we are not deaf. We actually can hear. Don't have to repeat. Just say once. And then, how do they define success? Oh, how do they define... Yeah, how do they define success? This is really, really interesting. One child says, if I don't get beating for one day. I say, what school do you attend? It says, Chinese school. that's how they define their success and their failure. But isn't that interesting that as one child said, my parents is almost perfect. But because we know that we are imperfect parents, and that's the only reason why our children needs a perfect God. Yeah. And so last time in Mother's Day, I shared all the things and all the feelings, all the feelings, all the struggles, all the pain, because it is to say that God's grace, mercy, and love is sufficient for the walk as God walks and journeys with us. And so I wanted for Johnson, my second son, to come out and share, really, his side of the version as a child. And if time permits, we thought we will be here as a panel facilitated by Dr. Chua Suhit and Pastor Elvin as they come, and that we could answer actually questions from the congregation. Would that be okay if time permits? All right? Okay, come, Johnson.
Thank you. Hello. Hi, good morning. Thank you so much for having me. So yesterday, to be very honest, so all this while I thought was just doing this panel. And then yesterday on the way while driving, my mom turns to me and said, hey, they're expecting you to preach tomorrow. So let me just put it out there. I'm really not in any position to preach to you. But what I would like to do today is really share my story. And perhaps, you know, you could... it'll be able to be relevant to you in any way. So just to introduce myself, I will just wait for the slides to come up. All right, slides are just there. Beautiful. Okay, so just to introduce myself, my name is Johnson Ui. I'm the co-founder and CEO of this social enterprise. We're a group of companies. It's called Epic Collective. EPIC, as Pastor Alvin said earlier, stands for Extraordinary People Impacting Community. Essentially, our vision is to create a cooperative world with response-able people driven by heart of service. We started being Malaysian with a lot of frustration. It's easy to get frustrated in this country, I suppose. You know, it's easy to blame the government for this and blame other people for that. But we realized that it doesn't have to be so. You know, and we don't actually have to live that way. In fact, we had within ourselves a lot of potential and a lot of abilities to make a difference. So this is a lifestyle that we're looking to introduce to people. And how we do that, because, you know, these words are not very easy to digest. What we do is we design experiences that people can go through to understand what exactly are we talking about. And one of them is this initiative that we've been running for the last 7 years, and it's called Epic Homes. Epic Homes is quite simply a non-profit initiative to provide safe and sustainable homes to marginalized communities and build relationships with them at the same time. To this day, we have built more than 100 homes in 10 different villages, with a builder community from over 55 countries and 5,000 people. But before I go into the work and everything like that, I wanted to be able to share with you a little bit about my story. You know, going back to the beginning, I suppose connecting with what my mom has already shared with you. So I tell a lot of people, I think some of the awesome people I met yesterday night, I started, and most of the time I start back in 2010 when we started this enterprise. But now, of course, at this point, looking back, it didn't start then. It actually started when I was born. So the thing is, you know, when I was younger, from the time I can remember, my mom and dad would tell me, you know, John said, you know, you are very special. Before you were born, someone said you were already in my womb. And you have a calling on you. Even your name as well, Johnson, Son of Grace, is given by God. You know, so you would think, wow, so special, right? You know, wow, you know, I so won. So what did I do? You know, did I? So yeah, I went to church. I didn't do that. In fact, there was a lot of running away. I started running away. It's like, come on, you know, I suppose. Coming from, I suppose, a typical Christian background. Mom and dad were pioneers of a pretty big church now, back in PJ, where, yeah, you know, growing up in this sort of background. And the expectation that was set was, okay, you know, if you're set aside, then you either need to be a pastor or a missionary. And, I mean, no offense, of course. But, I mean, for me, I realized that, no, I don't think that's for me. You know, so there was a lot of reluctance and a lot of rebellion, in fact. I think things escalated as well when my father passed away, when I was 13 years old. And yeah, I mean, it was quite traumatic. Although we had some time to prepare, it was traumatic and it was quite life-changing as well. But what it also meant was more freedom. Mom now had to go out to work. She had to play both father and mother, but at the same time she couldn't be there for most of the time. And so we're pretty much left to just grandparents and whenever they visited, and our helper back at home. So yeah, it was a fantastic time. You know, we went to school whenever we wanted to go to school. The first time I got drunk was when I was 13 years old. I started going clubbing when I was 15. Played around, you know, did all sorts of things that I shouldn't have been doing. Looking back as well, it was also because I believe that there was also a lot of resentment. You know, a lot of people said, you know, Johnson, you know, when my dad was sick, they said, oh, you know, he'll definitely not die. Don't worry. I have a vision of him walking, being there at your wedding. You know, he's going to be there and all that. But then he died, you know. And I think that although, you know, everything works out good for those who love the Lord. But I think at that age itself, I say, what a waste of time. you know, he, you know, God is, doesn't mean, you know, what he says. So yeah, I rebel and everything like that. And it was, I think, quite a tough time for my mom, you know. But of course, no, I didn't care. You know, I wanted to do what I wanted to do. You know, I wanted to play whenever I wanted to play. And so I think when we were growing up, I think my brothers and I think especially me, maybe I gave a lot of grief. I think I didn't do very well in school. I couldn't get into college the first time I tried. But during that time, you know, although I was doing all these sort of things, I think a lot of people were saying to my mom that she's a lousy, irresponsible mother. You know, that if my father was alive, that all this wouldn't happen. You know, so that was the kind of pressure that she had to struggle with, you know, on top of trying to balance, trying to get an income to work us through life, at the same time trying to keep up with us as well as we're going through puberty and our teenage years, you know, which can go by so rapidly. My younger brother was 11, I was 13, and my older brother was 16 when my dad passed away. So we were at quite a pivotal points in life, you know, 13 years old, you know, just learning, okay, what does it mean to be a man? And it's like, what is all this hair? You know, where is all this thing come from? What am I supposed to do? You know, and yet there wasn't a father figure behind it. So my mom had to play or try to play that role. And we didn't make things very easy as well. But in light of that, I mean, I realized that there was a lot of forgiveness that was shown. There was a lot of grace that was shown. In fact, I think one of the things that I really appreciate about my mom was providing an environment where we could be safe to admit mistakes and be able to then get correction in a gracious manner. You know, so it's, I think if you were in her position or if I was in the position, it would be pretty difficult because she couldn't be in control of anything. You know, there was three of us, three boys, running quite wild, doing it together as well, doing whatever we wanted to do. And quite naturally, you say, all right, you know, go stay in your room, you know, I'll cut your allowance and control these sort of things. But instead of that, she actually allowed us to make those mistakes. She allowed us to own those mistakes. And in that sense, then, every time we fail, we could then go up to her and say, okay, you know, this is what's happened. And she would say, all right, you know you've done wrong. See, you've messed up. But here's what we can do. You know, and so that was the kind of environment that she gave. But make no mistake, it wasn't like that to begin with. It didn't start that way. You know, you'd think, oh, wow, you know, the last time she spoke during Mother's Day, oh, no wonder her kids can be like that. She wasn't like that at all. There was... yeah, you know, she did the typical thing, run around the wooden spoon, and then she realized she can't keep up because we're too fast. You know, then she tried to guilt trip us and say, whatever, you know, we're going out. You know, we don't really care. And there were a lot of fights that we had. And I think at some point, I realized somewhere when I was 15 or something like that, that's when she actually sat us down and started to change the way she worked. I don't know what it was that triggered that realization within my mother, but I believe that really started to change. Did we change? No, we didn't. 15 years old, 16 years old, we didn't study at all. We skipped school. 17, we didn't do very well. Couldn't get into college. But she was a bit unusual, I suppose, you know, and it started, I think, back when I was 15. 17 years old, like I said, I couldn't get into college. Instead of taking me to the gallows to hang me or chop my head off, she said, let's go have some Japanese. I remember having sake in the afternoon. And she said, all right, let's celebrate today. So celebrate what? What is the catch? and she said, yeah, you know, today we learn a lot more. We learn so much more from failure than from success. And I know that it'll never happen again. And that was quite shocking to me. Did it happen again? Yeah, I failed a few more subjects after that as well. But yeah, you know, it was pretty difficult, and it was quite difficult to see where the heck would we end up as boys, you know, because there wasn't any clear signs or behaviors that were very ideal. You know, we weren't going to church. In fact, when I was, I think, 14 or 15, I left church. And so never go to church, you know, and then fail so much, you know, play so much, drink so much, smoke so much, you know, these sort of things. Where are these people going? And I think that, if anything, I mean, she tells me that she gets on her knees every day. And I suppose God was listening as well. And I remember one thing that I couldn't run away was this nagging feeling. You know, this voice inside my head or my heart. Every time I would be, you know, running around, doing things that I shouldn't be doing, there's always this nagging thought inside of my head. And I remember the day that I was truly born again. That was 2007. So that was 7 years after my dad passed away and had already gone through high school. 2007, I would be 20 years old. It was just a random occasion, but I had just gone through, just going through a season where some people would see living the good life, but somehow I was so lost. And I remember just watching TV one evening. And I had this weird feeling that I had to just go and get on my knees. And I hadn't prayed for the longest time. I haven't read the Bible. I haven't gone to church. And I haven't done anything like that at all. But somehow this feeling is like, oh, go get your knees. So I was like, okay, what the heck? All right. Turn off the TV. Went into my room. And I got on my knees. And I said, God, what do you want? You know, so annoying. And I wouldn't say there was a very clear voice or anything like that. But I felt like a whisper that says, what is it? You know, just tell me. And at that moment, I remember the God that I thought that I grew up with, you know, the God that, oh, I mean, yes, God is glorious. God is the maker of heaven and earth, the Alpha and Omega. He's, you know, this massive thing. But at the same time, he's a God that wants that fellowship, that relationship with you as well. And I realized that there's another side to him that I perhaps didn't know. I didn't want to test. You know, and what I said was, I said, F you, God. I did. You know, and I, oh, where's the lightning? You know. I said, yeah, I hate you. You know, you took away my father. You know, you said he was going to survive, but you took him away. And I just went through this whole spiel, and I just kind of just expressed myself. And I honestly, it's not like for 7 years I said, yeah, I've got this vendetta with God, you know. I didn't even know I had these things inside of me. But it all just came out. And it was that at that very moment where suddenly I could feel that love and that grace that people sing and they talk about. And I realized that, wow, you know, this is actually what it's about. And so it's quite a moment. I was, if not mistaken, I think maybe in my underwear or something in the room. I don't know why it was in my underwear or my boxers or something. And I was just crying, you know, just crying and weeping and shouting out. And then 4 hours had passed. But I remember very clearly that I said, fine, I give up, you know. I give up. I submit myself to you. Whatever that you want with me, just do it. And so that was 2007. Things changed immediately. Not really. I mean, one of the things was that, okay, I prayed a little bit more, read the Bible a bit more for the next 2 weeks, and then there's a plateau again. And then I got baptized in 2008. But I just felt that slight change, you know, that slight change going through this. And then it was 2009 where I had graduated from, I just graduated from university. And so I did communications and media management. And the reason why I took communications and media management was because I didn't know what I wanted to do. So normally people say, okay, what do you want to do? All right, I'll be a doctor. Okay, pursue biology that lead you to medicine, and then you become a doctor. I actually had no plans at all. I just wanted to get that degree so my mom would be happy and she wouldn't look so bad. So I did communications and media management. Why? Because it offered a wide range of different things. And I said, oh, if I have all these things, then I will be able to single out something by the end of 3 years. By the end of 3 years, I was even more confused than when I actually went in. I was supposed to decide what work I wanted to do. My mom asked me, what do you want to do? I said, to be very honest, I really like the outdoors. That's where my heart is. I did some rock climbing. I was a fitness instructor. Going outdoors, running, swimming, kayaking, climbing, that's my life. So I said, okay, I'm going to be a jet ski operator in Phuket. And that was my plan. And that was my plan. I don't know what my girlfriend at that time thought of it. but before that, we were part of this group called Growing Emerging Leaders, where we met up every Monday night. And every Monday night, what we would talk about would be just kingdom principles, leadership values, how can you actually apply this to real life? You know, so it's really just an open session, a lot of food to attract us and keep us there, and then get us to just, and then we would just be talking. After a while, it led to talking about how do we actually impact the community? How do we actually make a difference out there? How do we make nation transformation possible? So 4 years had passed. It started in 2000, maybe about 2007, 2006. And just so you know, my mom put us all in this thing. Okay, we were forced. She had a mentee, her name is Jasmine, that said, I'm very passionate about the youth, and I'm looking for youth. She couldn't find her own youth. So my mom said, yeah, I know the youth for you. Just take my sons. And by default, all the girlfriends were forced as well. They weren't too happy to begin with. But after a while, it actually turned out, you know, quite enjoyable. I think I was telling them yesterday, it was probably the food. The food was quite good. But we realized that we hadn't done anything. And we were going to start working. And we were saying, like, oh, once we start working, we won't be able to do anything like that at all. So we didn't want to look like hypocrites, or at least I didn't want to look like a hypocrite. And what happened was it led us to this place that you see in this picture. This is Kampung Jawa Kerling. This is the first Orang Asli village that we went to. What happened was we reached out to a man who was working with Orang Asli communities, and we said, hey, you know, whatever you need, we'll be there. We want to help you out. And he brought us here. And essentially, long story short, after a couple of visits, we realized that they needed a toilet and some paint for houses. And we said, can we make an activity out of it where we can actually bring people and then at the same time do it together with you guys? And to be very honest with you, this was my first community project. Although I grew up in church and stuff, I've never gone for any missionary trips. I've not done any community service. And normally, if someone sent this to me on Facebook, I'll click ignore. So I was quite cynical, to be very honest. And when we said, oh, we're going to get people to come, I said, who will come? I say maybe a maximum of 20 people, you know, perhaps the ones that are normally in this scene, you know, this charity scene, maybe they will turn up. But we put it out online and we got 64 people that turned up in 1.5 weeks. And these guys weren't just people within my circle of friends in Facebook, because we can track that. We probably got 6-7 people from that circle. The rest of them were strangers. And we got people from different countries that were going through. Even passing through Malaysia as well. There were some from Sweden, Korea, Japan, Vietnam. You know, so it was quite encouraging. And so the thing went well. It was a simple project. We built a toilet, shower place, and then we painted the houses together with the community themselves. I got two realizations from this. One was that contrary to what people believe, people are actually... Or, I mean, maybe for most of you, it's quite hard to believe, but Gen Y, you know, people hungry to serve. People are really hungry to serve. The issue is that they don't know where to go, what to do, who to do it with, how to do it. And that's what holds them back. Most of the opportunities that are available to them would be putting money into a box. And so the thing is, we live in this world of two extremes where we have to choose. Either you choose to make money, or you choose to help people and not make any money at all. And the best thing that you can do if you chose to make money is give me your money and then hope for the best. But I feel like, yes, that is one of the ways to do it. But I believe that a lot of us want to really get to the ground. We want to be able to see where our efforts actually lead to. You know, what kind of impact can it make in people's lives? And that is missing in a lot of people. And so when I saw so many people come together to do this and say, wow, can you tell me more when you have more of this? You know, I felt, wow, you know, this is actually something. The other was asking myself, how come I've never done anything like that before? You know, was it because I didn't care? Why? Because a lot of people say, oh, you know, you young people, you're apathetic bunch, you are, you know, your tida apa attitude, you have you're selfish, you only care about yourself. But it wasn't because we didn't care. I realized that the reason why I was not led to action was because I fell alone. I felt alone in terms of how much impact can I actually make as a person? You know, what will it actually result to if I'm the only one that cares? You know, worse still, other people will come and mess up the good that I'm trying to do. So it's quite logical. You know, why bother at all? But when I experienced this, when I personally put myself out there, become vulnerable to see if people actually wanted to join me. You know, one of the biggest fears for a lot of people is hosting a party and have no one turn up, right? And so this was that moment. But to have 64 people turn up in such a short amount of time was so encouraging. In fact, it also changed my mindset towards other people as well. And so you might think like, oh, then that was the light bulb moment and I made this my life. No. What happened was I told my mom, okay, you know, I think I might be onto something. Give me 3 more months before I find a job. You know, I'm not going to pay rent or anything. I'm still going to stay in the house. But just give me 3 more. Just give me 3 more months. And so just to add a little bit onto that, I believe that serving other people is not just about paying your dues or giving back. But I think there's a very, very fundamental need that all of us have. So if you understand the Maslow's hierarchy of needs, that's that pyramid, right? Where at the bottom of the pyramid, you look at the basic needs that we all have. So normally you have your food, you have your water, you have your air that you breathe. These are some of your basic needs. I believe that service is very much connected to purpose as well. Because I believe that each and every one of us, the reason of our existence is not for ourselves. It's always for other people. And if you want to find your purpose, you need to get out there. You need to be able to either physically do something for someone else or have that mindset or that lens where you're doing something for someone else. See, I think a lot of us, we pray and we ask God, no, bless me, you know, give me more gifts. But give me more clarity of purpose. The thing is, God blesses you with these things, but the question is, for what? It's never to bless yourself. It's always for somebody else. You know, it's for other people. And that's why I felt like maybe I'm onto something and that is what I like to do. How am I going to do it? I don't know. But maybe I'll just continue these sort of projects. So that led us to this other house. How are we doing for time? Yeah. Are we okay? Oh, thank you. Yeah. That's why my wife needs to come along. So that led me to this other village where this Orang Asli community introduced us to this place. So this is Kampung Hulu Tamu. And what you see over here is actually the first broken house that we saw. We thought it was a shed or a storeroom. And we asked around, and they said, it actually belongs to somebody, and he's been staying in it for the last 2 years. And so quite immediately, we wanted to build him a house and say, oh, we have to do something about it. Because we were still in that mode where, yeah, we know we've got to fix this. But then upon asking ourselves more questions, you know, we say, wait a minute, how did he end up in that situation in the first place? What's to prevent him from falling back into that same position? Why does he choose to live like this? How come no one's helping him? You know, and so we pretty much quite naively said, let's go and ask him, you know, which is fair, right? But I think our approach was, okay, we sat down with him and said, sir, we really care for you. We really are genuinely excited to help you. Just tell us whatever you need. Tell us what is your problem. And obviously, we didn't get anything. You know, what were we thinking? We're thinking that, you know, he would say, yes, the reason why I am in this position of poverty is because of these factors. Factors A, B. It didn't happen that way, unfortunately. And so we tried to pry information out of him, but I realized we weren't getting anywhere. And that's where you say, hey, you know, what's the issue? What's happening? And realized that we didn't have any trust. Although within us, we felt that love, we felt that kindness, we felt that care, there was no relationship at all. You know, we just wanted to come and help the person to do what we wanted to do without actually getting to know the person. And there was no trust at the same time. So why would he want to open up? First of all, open up to telling us stuff. And secondly, to even receive with an open heart. And that's where we were having a conversation. It's like, how do we then build a relationship? You know, because that would be our main objective now. How do we actually build a relationship? But at the same time, we're also faced with... Oh, wait. Okay. We're faced with this, you know, where friendship is not going to put a roof over his head. What are we going to do? And so I remember one of us just randomly saying, hey, what if we could build a house like Lego or IKEA, you know, where normal people could do it? You know, because in terms of the objective, reaching the objective of relationship building, raising funds, passing the contractor, coming back 4 months later, and then saying, hey, I bought you the house, you like or not, can we be friends, is not as effective as being able to work side by side, you know, shedding blood, sweat, and tears together. And because, I mean, at the end, the action speaks louder than words. And so we said, wouldn't that be pretty cool? Of course, there was also that cool factor, right? We imagine ourselves coming into school or going to work, or your friends asking, hey, what do you do over the weekend? Say, nothing much, just build a house. So there was also that lingering thought as well, I have to admit. And so we set ourselves a target that we wanted to be able to find out if there exists a design that allows ordinary unskilled volunteers to build these homes or to build a home in 3 days. Because we wanted to be able to make it accessible to any one of you, people with full-time jobs, people with studies. And so we went around, faced a lot of failure, but thanks to some really great people that's helped us out, it became a possibility. So this was 8 months after people were saying, no, don't waste your time. We couldn't find it on Google, just to put it out there. We didn't want to reinvent the wheel, but we couldn't find something like that on Google. So we came up with the first prototype. This prototype then was put on Facebook, shared with people, and soon we had people knocking on our doors, a lot of architects and engineers, saying, you know, actually your idea, nothing special. In fact, quite ugly, it's like a chicken coop. Maybe if you bring me on your team, we can make it prettier for you. And we said, sure, why not? Fantastic. Early on, nobody wanted to help us. At least now people want to help us. You know, so we were very happy to bring them on board. And then on top of that, people started to notice what we're trying to do. And so I think about 6 months later, we also got funding, a grant. And this grant, I have to be honest with you, comes from 1MDB. Yeah. So I got 150,000 ringgit to build 7 homes. We built 8. Just to put it out there, we built 8. So no money was wasted in the process as well. There was no champagne with Paris Hilton or anything like that. But it kind of grew. And so that was the house that was built. Following that, we decided to do it full time in 2011. 2010, I was still working part time actually every Sunday as a English essay writing teacher, and that was the only thing I was doing to support this hobby of mine. And then 2011, I was quite privileged to have someone have me as a research assistant in a university. And that was really just to pay the bills. It was kind enough. He knew what I was trying to do. In 2011, basically, I quit that job and then jumped into this full-time. One of the things that I hope that you get out of this is when it comes to purpose, is that it doesn't come, you know, God doesn't give a 36-page business plan. You know, when you say, God, give me clarity, give me your plans and your purpose, wow, you know, you get this, okay, all right, son, you know, there you go. Right. This is look through the summary. Okay. It doesn't happen that way. I feel like God really leaves breadcrumbs, and it doesn't perhaps appear as purpose to start with, but it could start with a gut feel. And the key to unlocking this purpose is obedience. There needs to be action. That obedience that's done in faith. That's when he slowly reveals that more and more and more and more to you. So it didn't make sense why the heck we were chasing this feeling or this gut feeling. But something just told me that, okay, you know, just keep doing this. You know, it wasn't going anywhere. My mom, even my mother, said, hey, son, when are you going to get a job? You know, this thing, you can do it as a hobby. It's okay, do it as a hobby. But go get a job. My grandmother was... My grandma say, "Hey, come, Johnson, lie, JJ Bing." Then say, "Oh, yesterday, I prayed to Jesus to get you a proper job." You know, because she say every day, "Yo, every day this guy playing computer." You know, because I would sit there, you know, I'll be sitting in the living room or sitting in different rooms, so I'll be on my computer. But she doesn't understand that there's actually work inside the computer. So they say every day he play computer only. It wasn't something where, oh, you know, I could articulate things and this is exactly why I want to do it, you know, why we want to help people and how this is going to grow into this massive thing that will really impact the world. It was nothing like that. The plan was really built one house. They kind of just snowballed, and then we decided, let's give it another 3 months, 6 months, 1 year. And then in 2011, about 2 years later, I think it was towards the end, I said, all right, you know, in order for this thing to grow, there needs to be some commitment put into this. You know, let's just do it. So we went into it, and we were quite okay. We'll go there. Yeah. So because I suppose of being able to focus a lot more, then houses were also enhanced. The experience was also enhanced, and that's how we managed to get to that number. So yeah, the chicken coop was the first prototype, but we rapidly improved on it. So if you look at these homes, this particular one is an 800 square feet home. Behind is a rainwater harvesting system, connected to a filtration system in the kitchen. There's two toilets, there's a septic tank system, and all of this is built in 4 days. So these ones as well, or similar types like this, those are done in 3 days. And the whole idea of being able to do it that way is not just about putting up a house, but there's also a sense of camaraderie and friendship and relationship that are being built in the process through using the house as a medium to connect people or build bridges. We're able to connect people groups that, in normal circumstances, do not actually come together. You know, so city people or urbanites, and the most rural of the rural, those that are in our indigenous people, and we're able to break down barriers. You know, where people people from the city are saying, oh yeah, you know, I thought they're like that because they're lazy and they've got mindset issues. But in fact, I want to be like them too. You know, in fact, actually a lot of us are trying to be like them, right? We work really hard, we save up, and then we buy a land, a piece of land in a forest somewhere, and then we retire there. You actually want to be orang asli. And on the other hand as well, then we also get... You okay for time? Yeah. So on the other hand, then we also get the orang asli people themselves, who previously might have thought, oh, I don't want to mingle with these guys. They don't really think too highly of me. You know, actually, I heard, you know, sometimes they want to cheat you. You know, city people are like that. But then by mixing you with you guys, they say, wow, you know, we're actually all the same. Even though they went to university, they're not very clever. Actually, sometimes I'm quite clever. They don't even know how to go fishing. You know, they don't even know how to. You know, they're so unfit. You know, just do a bit of work, they like cannot do already. You know, holding the hammer, you can't even hold the hammer. What is wrong with these men? You know, and on top of that, I thought that kind of reaffirms to them, right? Sometimes you need someone else to come and reaffirm. And in that sense, give back that dignity as well. The houses that you see over here, the reason why we wanted to make it modular and make it this way was also because we wanted to ensure that the process acknowledged their decision or their power of choice. So one of the determining factors to, or one of the differentiating factors for poverty to us, we believe was, the definition of poverty to us is really the type of mindset. And one of its differentiating factors is the ability or the capacity to make a decision or a choice. So basically, if you look at a person that has money and no money, a person that has money has a lot of options, has a lot of choice. That's what you think. And then on the other hand, they don't have money, so they have to do things because they have no choice. And based on circumstances, basically, this is just how it is. And so we looked at the type of houses that were being produced and realized that if we were going to give them a house based on the qualification that they are poor enough and not giving them the chance to choose what kind of house they are going to live in, then for 20 to 30 years, we are actually building an environment that will constantly remind them that the reason why you live in this place is because you are simply poor enough. And so we wanted to change that process. And so we made it as modular as possible. When we talk to families, they get to choose where their house would like to be orientated. A lot of architects hate that because logically it should be where the sun rises and sets and where the wind blows. But sometimes they would just like their house to face their favorite flower or their favorite tree. When they open their window, it makes them happy. Where they want their bedrooms to be, the living room, the kitchen. What color do they want their house to be? Although they somehow always end up with policeman blue. Somehow. So it really irks the architects. Usually they want it nice and we've got like gray tone. We have all those contemporary colors, which a lot of us would then choose. But these guys will go for the funky ones. And you're like, what the heck, you know? But it changes things, right? So at the same time, I'm just going to skip this. We have all sorts of people that come through our doors. Not just the typical people-minded ones and noble ones. In fact, most of the time you get the rest. You get people who are guilt-tripped. You know, the ones that come and wants to give back because they've been probably guilt-tripped by a $3.99 Saving African Child advertisement. Or the seekers, which are a lot of us too. You know, actually, why do we do what we do? You know, I just want to get away and do something different and maybe I can find purpose. We get the pressure, you know, because we work with a lot of companies and their bosses force them and they're afraid that they'll get demoted or not get the promotion and they turn up. And then we also get the hopeless as well, which is a lot of us. No one has really given us that chance or helped us out. Why should I come and help? You know, why should I give up my time, pay money and do hard labor? One of the things that we realized was that regardless of who you are going through this experience, they face an increase in their belief, behavior, attitude, and skills, pretty much like the experience that I've been through as well and many others. And so that's when it kind of changed within us that Epic wasn't about the house. Because for the longest time, that was the most tangible thing. And so it's easiest to say. You know, if someone asks you, what do you do? Ah, build houses for Orang Asli. Ah, very good, very good. You know, if you say, oh, we're trying to change the minds of people, trying to give them service experiences so they can uncover their own potential, they're like, yeah, okay, how, what the heck is that? So we realized that it wasn't just about the house. Epic is really about people. And so that's when we looked at our model. So we were using the medium of a home, using the channel of community service, but what was constant was the experience that we're providing to people. Love, hope, friendships, personal growth, capacity building, teamwork. These were some of the things that people were experiencing. I believe these are quite kingdom-based principles. But we realized that we didn't have to be restricted to just community service. In fact, we could do it as team building as well. And so this is where we also had that moment where someone told us that in order for us to survive, we need to put our operations into these homes. That's logical, fair enough. So that we put in 10,000 ringgit because we could only build one home every 3 months and we needed about that amount to sustain ourselves and all our part-time workers. But it made that house 50,000 ringgit, which was way outside the bracket of a lot of CSR companies. And so we said, you know, because no companies are paying for these homes and no one's able to fund these homes, then we're starting to lose relevance. We're starting to people's enthusiasm are starting to die out. You know, we're losing momentum. And so what exactly do we favor? Impact and momentum or our survival? And so that's when we said, screw survival. Take that out. Let's just strip away with it and let's just build as many homes and just hope for the best. Because if people know what we're doing, they would then, if they see the value of the work that we're doing, they would then want to support us. And that is somehow our business mantra. You know, you ask me what a business plan or whatever it is, this is pretty much it. You know, show value, give as much value to anybody, and somehow they will reward and take care of you. And so by removing that 10,000 ringgit, we then had to rethink how we did things. So that's when our social enterprise model, social business model started. So we looked at what we were doing, you know, with the effect that we had and said, hey, you know, what if we could actually turn it into a team building activity and sell it to companies, you know? And so, long story short, I think a lot of people at first said, are you kidding me? Not only are you going to get me to pay for the houses, you're also going to you're going to take away the weekends of my staff, so they're going to think I'm a really bad boss. And then on top of that, you're going to make me pay, or you take away their productive hours, and then make me pay an extra for team building activity. People say, wow, you're a con man. You know, what kind of thing is that? But we were quite sure that the experience itself was very, very powerful. And we knew that that there were money parked in HR, if not CSR, because truthfully, no one parks a lot of money in CSR. And the moment economy is bad, people, you know, will reduce the amount. But HR is a constant. You constantly need to train your people. And so we realized that, hey, actually that works too. Of course, after a lot of failure, then somebody gave us that shot and that pretty much snowballed. You know, so we've worked with big multinational companies, over 50 companies. We've worked with people like GE, Prudential, Nestle, Tetra Pak, Air Asia, Gamuda. So some of the big names out there that's bought into this. And most of them actually pay for this as a team building activity. You'd think that a lot of people do it out of their philanthropic funds. It actually comes a lot more from team building, probably about 70% of our funding. And so that kind of taught me something, right? Like, by stripping away that operations cost I think it put us in a position where we also had to challenge that notion of, hey, you know, if you want to help people, you help yourself first. Go eat. Make sure that you eat. Make sure that you can eat rice first. Then only you take care about other people. I think this sort of mindset then causes us to create dams. you know, where you want to accumulate it, and like a dam, you can then control how much water you want to let out, you know, so that you want to keep it safe. But I don't think that's what we've been called to be. I don't think we've been called to be dams. I think if one analogy is constantly repeated, it's a river. You know, if you're not confident that you can be a river, at least we can be a stream. But a constant thing is that the water is constantly flowing. You know, and flowing water usually is clean water. When it's stagnant, that's when it gets murky, and that's when diseases and whatever breeds. You know, so I was just thinking, I mean, just at that, just down there, that's kind of like our faith as well. You know, it's kind of like the knowledge that we sit and we accumulate. You know, if there's no outlet, then basically it all gets pretty murky. I used to be a trainer, you know, and we tell people that the muscle building doesn't actually happen in the gym. It actually happens in the kitchen and when you sleep. That's when muscles are built. When you go to the gym, that's when you put your body under stress. You know, but there needs to be a good amount of that in order for you to grow. And if not, then if you're constantly just eating in the gym and sleeping, then what happens? We actually get obese. But there needs to be an outlet so that your body can start to take shape into its optimum form to actually achieve a certain task or a certain objective. You know, so I think it's the same thing as well for us. You know, there needs to be that outlet. You know, we come here, you know, to get our food. I think a lot of people say, oh, you know, because I don't really go to a church. So people say, oh, how do you get your food then? You know, yes, you get a lot of food in church. But if that's all you're getting, but you're not actually going out there to exercise, to do the work, then you're only going to get obese. You know, things are not going to make a lot of sense. So we also realize that, you know, impact doesn't need to take form in only one way. In fact, just because we can do it through team building, you know, and it doesn't just need to be homes. It could also be sanitation through personal development. It could also be professional. Who says that just because you are receiving a dollar for your work, that it takes away the genuineness of your service or your intention? You know, why does it have to be validated by a stamp that says non-profit? Why does it need to come in the form of charity? Then only you feel like something good is happening. Actually, impact can happen in many forms. You know, so that same thing as well, I think, like our faith. You know, it does not need to only take the form of the forms that we're familiar with the church or with our religion. You know, it can actually take many, many forms. I believe that God is a very creative God. So basically, EPIC, we believe that we design environments, and these environments then create experiences that helps each other become an epic person, and this epic person then goes on to wherever environment they go to, and they turn it into an epic environment of their own. This pretty much forms our business model, where we design external environments, so it could be your homes, your schools, your work, your public parks, basically environments that you mingle with on a day-to-day basis. That has a great way of influencing us. And at the same time, we look at internal environments as well. Your belief systems, your attitude, your skills, your behavior. And we see how do we actually marry both of them together. And so that forms the two companies that we have. It's called Epic Communities and Epic DNA. This is our community development arm. We're not just looking at non-profit, rural projects for marginalized communities, but we're also working with private developers as well, working with town councils and municipals. We're looking at places where people will be people would have to pay about $2 million, you know, at the lowest fee to stay in this establishments, and we've been given the opportunity to integrate this sort of belief system and this kind of lifestyle into their physical environment itself. And of course, then Epic DNA, looking at using service experiences for individual team and leadership development. So we embed ourselves in schools, in universities, in the middle of university, in your workplace for workforce preparedness, and even in companies as well. And one of the things that we realize is that when, you know, you can you can play all sorts of things and simulate all sorts of things, but nothing beats really being out there and challenging the elements. That's where I think a person's true character reveals itself. Just to add a little bit more. It's not easy. It's not easy, definitely. We didn't know really where this was going. We were really just taking it a step at a time, and somehow, as many times I wanted to fail, thanks to my wife, and perhaps things also falling into place at the right time, at the right place, I think, like the testimony earlier. We've experienced that so many times. In fact, for about three years, when we moved into our last office, we needed to pay about 6,000 ringgit a month for our office, but we needed to make that move. We only had 1 month rental in our pockets, and we still made that move. And then since then, we've steadily grown from 4 people to now 30 people, or actually it was about 25 people at that time, with 1 month in our pockets. Yeah, I know a lot of you advise your kids not to join me. but somehow, I was telling them yesterday, there was just this overwhelming peace. You know, like the song that we sang earlier, "You're My Hiding Place." You know, I believe that it's not just a fixed hiding place, but the hiding place moves with you, but it requires you to move. You know, and then that shelter, that refuge, that strength, and everything gets activated. So we grew to a certain point, and then most recently, we launched in April all our new company. So this new vision, the companies and stuff, is a new one after 7 years. And we did this with actually no money in our pockets. We were at the end of our finances. There was only one possible funding opportunity, and it was the most unlikely funding opportunity. And I just wanted to share with you, like, what happened was, we prayed, of course. We were like, "God, why? You know, why are we doing this? You know, you let us 7 years so that you can just abandon us." It sounds familiar, right? And I remember, like, we're just praying and dealing all sorts of things. And then I had this dream one night, and this was towards, I think somewhere around April, where a lot of these sort of things happened. I had a dream. And so in this dream, I saw a mentally handicapped person on a wheelchair. He was, I believe, like the most handicapped person I've ever seen. So physically, he was on a wheelchair, and also mentally as well. And he was speaking gibberish. And then there was like a narrator right next to me and said, "Hey, look, you know, this person, you know, that person inherited all the money and all the companies and assets and all that of his father, you know. But father still chose to give to this guy." And I say, "How can?" You know, so I was upset. I say, "What the hell? That doesn't make sense." And then you would see all sorts of people just walking to this guy in the wheelchair. And they would say, yes, sir, that sounds fantastic. Great idea. On the way. You know, right on. And so people will come and go, you know, all people of different kind of backgrounds and different kinds of stature. I say, "No, what the heck is this? You know, do you even see that? How is that logical?" And then somehow there was like a camera, I don't know, I like movies as well. So it kind of just zoomed out. And there was a caretaker for this guy. And the caretaker was pushing him around. It's like, "Yeah, okay. Oh, very good. Fantastic, sir." I realized that the caretaker was also helping him translate things for him as well. And I looked at it. I was like, "Oh, my goodness." And somehow inside, I knew, oh, that caretaker is Jesus. And then immediately the narrator, you know, that's you. And so I woke up laughing, in fact. I just went down on my knees immediately. And I said, "Lord, I'm so sorry. You know, I repent. You know, I have pride in my heart." You know, and one of the things that I learned in that moment is that it's not about what you do. So we cry out to God and say, "Hey, you know, we're helping poor people. You know, this is what you want me to do, what, right?" But in fact, it's really about who we become. You know, who God wants us to be. That's what He cares about. So He doesn't care about, oh, whether you run out of money or whether suddenly everybody shames your name or anything like that. But He cares about the condition of your heart itself. You know, so that moment, following that, then there was the deliverance, of course. Then right at the dot, when we needed funds, we got our first loan after 7 years. And that has now given us a lifeline for our entire company to be able to do this business. But that's really why I learned that God doesn't care about just doing the work. Actually, He cares about you. You know, and that's when I realized that actually at the end of the day, what are we preparing for? What's all this for? The purpose is really at the end of the day to bring His kingdom. You know, we pray, you know, our Father in heaven, hallowed be thy name, thy kingdom come, thy will be done. So that comes first, and then you ask for your daily bread. You know, a lot of us, we ask for daily bread first, please God, I fill my stomach first, then I do for you. And what are all these things for? I believe that this life is just an exercise. It's just an audition for eternity. And whatever whatever passions that is put within us that then leads to our purpose is what we're meant to do in this entire body. You know, and that's why it's so important to remember that it's not about what we do. We could be doing all sorts of things. You know, one day you can be a professional, another day you could be a father, a grandfather, you could be an Uber driver whenever you feel like it, you could be a builder. It's not about what you do. By the end of the day, what He cares about is about who you become. Because we are prepared for eternity. And that's what matters. Yep, that's all I have. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Johnson. Thank you for staying back. Right, yeah. Time is catching up, and I hope whatever that he shared today is an inspiration to some of you. I just want to close this time. If you have questions, you can always come forward and talk to Johnson. Let's close this time with a word of prayer. Father, I thank you for your presence in this place. Thank you for this time that you have gathered us together to worship you and also to listen to the stories of how you have impacted people, how you have used people, Lord, to impact others, Lord. We pray, O God, that whatever that you have spoken today, Lord, will spur us, Lord, into action. Father, we pray as we go on our separate ways that your blessing will be upon our lives, O God. May your peace be upon our homes, be upon our lives, and may you cause your favor, O God, to shine on us, Lord. We pray this in Jesus' name. Amen.